It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what makes a movie, old or new, a classic? We ask you to share a classic movie you think everybody ought to watch at least once. First, for many people, the pandemic has resulted in some big changes in the way we work, including where we work, how much we work, and what's expected of us. It also has some people reconsidering the idea of a four-day work week. And we're not necessarily talking about working four 10-hour days, but maybe fewer hours overall with no change in pay. Spain is about to experiment with a 32-hour work week, though a lot of the details are still up in the air for a pilot project. According to The Guardian, the trial could begin this fall and last 3 years at a cost of nearly $60 million. Some researchers and advocates say the lighter load would improve an employee's work-life balance and increase productivity. There are concerns, though, about staffing and scheduling challenges. Tell us what you think of the idea now at 800-642-1234. Does the idea of working fewer hours, maybe even at the same pay, seem like a good idea, or is it too good to be true? Do you feel burned out working 40 hours or more a week? Even if you do like your job, what do you think about the 4 10-hour day schedule? If you own or manage a business, what do you think a 4-day work week would do for your, say, scheduling and hiring? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Peter Capelli is the George W. Taylor Professor of Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and Director of Wharton's Center for Human Resources. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of the 4-day work week concept, Peter, in this year into the pandemic world, do you see a lot of business owners and managers maybe more open to different ideas about how they run their workplaces than they might have been pre-pandemic?
I think so. I think especially on this issue of working from home, before the pandemic, we more or less just let local managers make the decision. And, there was one group of managers that thought if you're working from home, you were watching Gilligan's Island all day and you were just goofing off. And the others had thought, as long as you get your work done, it doesn't matter. And the problem with that was, or one of the problems, you could be in the same company working for this person, doing exactly the same job. They'd let you work from home, working for this other person, maybe even across the hall, and they wouldn't. And it was, largely about their view of human nature. It didn't have anything to do with evidence. But now they got a little more evidence. So I think we're going to see companies taking away that discretion and having more general principles that allow more people to work from home.
I love that Gilligan's Island is the go-to for work at home slackers. I'm going to assume that's always what people are watching. Now, the 4-day work week, and people have been talking about this idea for a long time now. It's getting this look in Spain. And the people who argue for this say, actually, if we work less, we actually get more done with our time. There's more productivity. Do you see evidence to support that, though, Peter?
Yeah, probably not, to be honest, which doesn't mean that it's not true. It's just this question of evidence. So you might ask your listeners this, do they really have a good idea, or do they think their employer has a good idea how productive one person is as opposed to another person? We don't measure individual productivity very well at all. I think what happened in the pandemic was that managers did realize, though, that the earth didn't, and the sky didn't fall when people were working from home. They didn't notice any difference. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't a difference. It just meant that they maybe weren't even all that good at being able to tell. So I don't think we're going to see, dramatic improvements in that area. I think the 4-day work week and these efforts, particularly in Europe, to reduce working hours came from a kind of different notion, particularly in France. And that notion was the idea that there were only so many jobs around, only so much work to be done. And if you could scale it back, it would actually create more jobs, And there was a joke at the time when this started in France that there was some sort of conference where the French were meeting Californian workers and Silicon Valley workers. And they were talking about this, I think it was 37-hour week or something like that in France. And the Silicon Valley guys said, "That's great. Then you could work two jobs, right?" And it just, defeated the whole purpose of thinking about it, right? But I don't think there's any evidence that the French were right about that. And I don't think there's any good evidence in France that it actually helped create any more jobs. So I think that idea, which was part of the motivation for cutting back work hours, doesn't seem to be right. That doesn't mean the other ones couldn't be right. You know, certainly might be better for people. And, you know, it's possible you might get just as much done as if you worked more hours. It is certainly true that if you start really upping the hours of work, productivity per hour begins to drop really fast.
I know there's a concern among employers, especially at places where, you know, you have to have some people on the job. If you're at a store or a call center or a restaurant, whatever, you need people in there. If everybody's working fewer hours, you're going to need more employees to cover those calendars. And there's a certain fixed cost per employee. How big an obstacle do you see that being?
Well, I think in those cases, it is a big obstacle. I think if we're thinking about what is it that employees really want, I think one of the things broadly is let's do something about kind of egregious overwork. This is particularly where people who were non-exempt, that is, they were covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if you started working more than 40 hours a week, you had to be paid overtime. When those people and that kind of work gets moved to exempt, which means you're paid a salary, you're not paid by the hour. Once you're in that category, there's no limits on your hours of work, right? And there's no overtime pay. So in those cases, we see, you know, like store managers and those things, right? We see the hours of work effectively just going up and up and up. And on those folks, they might find they're working 55, 60 hours a week or so. So, you know, it's the problem is not so much the average hours of work, which frankly don't sound all that bad, the average in the economy. It's the people who are really being pushed to do more and more and more without overtime pay. Those are the people who are really being kind of pushed around here.
We're talking to Peter Capelli, professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the idea of the four-day work week, which might mean a 32-hour work week. And we want to hear what you think of the concept, pro or con, or a little of both, and your questions, too, at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Heather is with us in Oregon. Heather, hi.
Hi. Okay, so I'm for it. I think we can maybe get closer to an actual normal work week. But and what your expert had to say was some of the things that I had to say, which is France did it because they were trying to basically spread, you know, X numbers of hours over Y number of people and therefore employ a greater percentage of the population. I don't think that that's our problem in our country. I think we have a shortage of labor, if you look at it. But our issue is literally what he said, which is we have too many people who are being pushed to work more, more, more. It's the do more with less problem. So I'm hopeful that this might stop that. But my question is, how is this going to be enforced? Because in France, what you saw was that they would literally raid businesses. In fact, I was there watching it on TV when I was over there doing business for our biotech company, and they were raiding construction sites and restaurants, which were the two businesses that were most likely to basically break the rules. And they literally have police that go in the front of the restaurant, and you see the employees run out the back of the kitchen, and the cops are chasing them. And it made for great comedy TV, but the question is, how do we enforce it?
Interesting, Heather. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Peter, how do we enforce we enforce 40-hour work weeks for some people, sort of. How would enforcement work, do you think?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The U.S. Department of Labor is the biggest enforcement agency in the federal government. And, you know, this falls to their wage and hour division to do. And, you know, it is a good question about whether we are enforcing that well enough. If you look at the people who study what they call wage theft, which is people not getting overtime pay or not getting breaks, you know, they seem to indicate that it's quite widespread. You know, it's not that difficult to enforce this if you had the will to do it. But, you know, there are political debates on this, right? There are people who believe that employers are already overburdened by regulations and complying with these things just gets picky. And so we shouldn't spend a lot of time and effort trying to enforce it. And then there are those who believe there are a lot of violations, and we should, right? So you see this battle between the Democrats and Republicans. You've seen it in Wisconsin. You see it at the federal level. And, you know, you see the Democrats imposing new regulations, and then you see the Republicans trying to cut them or not funding them so you can't actually execute them, you know. So a lot of these issues are really about political differences and political will. What do you really want to do? And I think when push comes to shove, we discover that we're just not agreeing on what it is we want to do. And that's the heart of the problem.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Vince now in Madison. Vince, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you might speak to how you think this might affect income disparities between salary and hourly workers. Thank you.
Vince, thanks for the call. Is there a salary disparity, first of all, between us salaried and hourly workers? And would this affect it, do you think, Peter?
Well, I think it might affect the living standard differences, the quality of life differences, right? So I think right now the people who come off the worst on this are the people who are just above the hourly wage positions. So these are lower level supervisors and store managers and those folks who don't get overtime hours, but end up getting overtime work effectively, you know, lots more things that have to be done than could be done in a 40-hour work week. So I think what would happen then if you could pull those folks, those hours of those folks down or give them, you know, overtime pay, is that the jobs would be a little more equivalent. I mean, you're actually probably almost better off not being a supervisor in those circumstances because your hours of work, you don't make as much money maybe, but your hours of work are nowhere near as great. So I don't know that it would probably address income inequality as much as it would those gaps for the lower level white collar workers where they find their hours of work are just really up, but their pay doesn't go up with it.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the pros and cons of the 4-day work week with Peter Capelli, professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, director of Wharton's Center for Human Resources. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of making the norm a 4-day work week? What would you do with the extra time? Do you feel like you'd have a better work-life balance? Should it be a law that we have this, or would you like to see individual businesses give it a shot? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about 4-day work weeks, a concept that's been getting a fresh look since the pandemic. Some researchers say working fewer hours at the same pay might boost productivity. Others say it would result in staffing and scheduling challenges. Peter Capelli is with us, professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, as a political conservative, I would love something like this, but the real issue would be, isn't this the best use of unions, where you definitely have workers being abused by keeping them on a salary and then abusing them on through an hourly work schedule? This is where unions should be strong to protect workers from being abused. And they can then negotiate whether it's a 5-day week, work week, 4-day work week, or whatever work week works best for the company as well as the worker. But we should not have workers being abused, and that is where the unions should be most active. Thanks for my call.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. And I know, Peter, union supporters credit unions with helping create what we have now as the 40-hour work week standard, but unions have declined a lot in the recent decades. Do you see a role for unions in trying to negotiate for these kind of working times and changes?
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, have held the view of your caller. And you know, as he says, a lot of conservatives have that view that this is something we should work out at the local level. You know, the problem is unions are so weak, and it's not just the fault of unions, right? We've spent a lot of time and a lot of political energy and a lot of lobbying to make sure that they stay weak. So, you know, the problem is, as a political solution, to just say unions should do that doesn't mean very much because they can't do it. You know, they can't get organized. It's difficult for them to get members it's easy to stop. You're seeing some stories in the paper now about practices at Amazon and elsewhere that are pretty aggressive. And, you know, even some things that might violate the law, like if I'm an employer and I can fire people who support the union, that's violates the law, but it's not the criminal law, it's civil law. And, you know, what happens as a result of that? The National Labor Relations Board may say, okay, you fired those folks illegally, but that's 2 years later, the election's over, there's no union, right? So, you know, I think as a practical matter, it's not going anywhere, at least not until the unions somehow get much stronger. And frankly, I'm not betting on that anytime soon unless the political environment changes in a big way. So we're left with something else. I think the idea that employers should sort of figure this out and where it works, do it, sounds great. But I think one thing to remember about employers is they're just people, right? I mean, they're just people like everybody else. They've got the same limitations, particularly in the academic world. We often think that they're this rational calculating machine, you know, that employers have figured out the absolute best way to do everything and they've analyzed things. And none of that's true. I mean, nobody has time to do that or the ability or the energy. So they go with rules of thumb, you know, just ideas that sound right, you know. So it's largely about ideas. And I think, you know, the idea that you might actually get more productivity by people working less hours and ultimately more performance out of them just doesn't sound right to people. And so it's not going to go anywhere unless we can persuade them that this might actually be true. And in terms of the evidence and things, we're still a little ways from that. You know, there are places right now where they've got 4-day work weeks. 25% of the U.S. workforce has shift work already. And where you have shifts, for example, in healthcare, it's not uncommon now for nurses to work 3-day weeks. They work 3 12-hour shifts, right? And the reason there is there's a particular need for people to stay with the same patients as long as possible because you get that continuity of care. But that's not likely to be the case in an insurance company or someplace else, right? So I think if we ever see a 4-day work week, it will be business by business, industry by industry. It's not something that's going to work across the economy. It just doesn't fit lots of places.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We're talking to Peter Capelli from the University of Pennsylvania, professor of management there, looking at the idea of a 4-day work week and taking your many calls. Back to you. Barbara is with us now in Hudson. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Barbara?
My question to the experts is this. If we transition from a 40-hour work week to a 32-hour work week, how does that translate to healthcare benefits and benefits as full-time employees? Would that follow across the board? Would a 32-hour work week still retain your benefits?
Barbara, thanks for the call. And that is an interesting and huge question, Peter, if we change our standard work week.
Yeah, well, there's no reason why it couldn't or shouldn't. You know, there are employers who make decisions about not giving people healthcare benefits in particular if they're working part-time status, right? And, you know, given those policies that employers have, if they cut you below that, then you'd have a problem. But, you know, if employers wanted to introduce lower work weeks, they could probably do it, right, without losing your benefits. I think the problem, though, is that, you know, let's be real. Employees want lots of things, and we don't get it, right? And that's not too surprising. Some of these things cost money to do. Some of them are hard to do. So where we might make progress is if you could see some reason why the employer might want them as well. So, for example, if you said, would I be willing to take a lower wage for a shorter work week, right? Now, if you could do that, maybe you might entice more employers to think that way, at least in those jobs where it might make sense to not have 40-hour work weeks for people. You know, the problem in offices is, at least before the pandemic, we had 5-day work schedules. We had meetings scheduled 5 days a week. And if you got a bunch of people who are only coming in 4 days a week, you know, it sort of complicates life if you're trying to get meetings done and things like that. But, you know, we'll see now that enough employees have been working remotely anyway. Does it matter that much if you're working a 4-day work week, if we've just gotten through a period where you weren't there at all? You know, maybe employers are used to it and they'd be more open to it if they saw a business reason to do it. And I think that's still the problem. How does it help them to do that? That's not so clear.
Thanks for the call. Tim joins us next in Pembine. Tim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Tim?
Okay, I'm planning on getting business in the near future, like pretty soon, and I'm thinking about how to schedule people and all this. But the one thing that keeps coming to my mind, and I've been thinking about it for a while and has been kind of locked onto it, there's studies that say that people's minds work physically, taxable, you know, all the different phases you use your mind. After 6 hours, your brain starts to shut down. The human brain starts to shut down after 6 hours of work. So you notice, like, even people that are older, you know, depending on their diet, I guess, and their hormones and all that, that they slow down more, you know, the energy, even to have the energy. So
I got you, Tim. We just have a minute or two left. Peter, I mean, we've all felt that kind of brain fog at the end of a long work day. Is that anecdotal or is there something to that?
Well, mine shuts down much sooner than that, I must say. I don't even get a full 6 hours myself. I think, you know, it's an argument about taking breaks. It is true more generally that once people get really tired, their productivity really, really falls. And, you know, that was a big issue in healthcare, right? It's an issue with these nurses who are working 12-hour shifts. So there's something to that. I think that's an argument that makes people concerned about fewer days and longer hours, right? If you're working a 10-hour shift rather than an 8-hour shift, does that last 2 hours, additional 2 hours, just burnout time? That might not matter if what you're doing doesn't require a lot of cognitive energy, but if it does, maybe that's something we want to think about. I think flexibility is really what employees most want. And is there a way to give them more of that, where they might work from home for a little bit? They might have more control over their hours, and particularly they might get more vacation time, which is something we've been really bad at in the U.S.
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Peter Capelli is a professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, director there of the Center for Human Resources. We talked to him about the pros and cons of a 4-day work week. Heard from a lot of you on email and Facebook, by the way. Brandy says, I've done 4 10-hour shifts. It was awesome. If you did work an overtime day, you still had 2 days off. And Janine says, I switched to a 4 8-hour day work week as a way to transition into retirement. Learned I won't have any problem finding things to keep me busy in retirement, using the time to art journal, write real letters, so and more. You can keep sharing your thoughts and experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about classic movies, however you want to define that. Movies you think everybody should watch at least once. We'll talk to a Wisconsin film professor, and you can join in with your selections. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, a Grammy Award-winning singer from Wisconsin joins the show to talk about her career in classical music. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, despite the long history of cinema and the many movies we have access to these days, it can still be tough sometimes to pick out a good one. But there are some reliable favorites, classics that have been tested by time and many viewers. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What is one movie that is a classic in your book? What makes a movie a classic in your book? What's a movie you think everyone should watch at least once? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Now, Jocelyn, what does a classic mean to you? And maybe you have a personal answer and a film professor answer. I don't know.
I always have both film studies professor answers and personal answers, Rob. I think we can think about classics in a couple ways. The standard way of thinking about it would be to say, well, a film that's a classic is kind of like a pinnacle of the form, right? It embodies everything that had kind of led up until that moment, and it represents a kind of culmination. So we might think of a lot of classic American films as from the era of classical Hollywood cinema, from, you know, about the time that sound enters the picture, as it were, at the end of the 1920s, beginning of the 30s, till around the end of the Paramount decrees and when the studios break up, which kind of goes on until the end of the 1950s. So I think about classical films, but then also classics, right? Classics might not only be those that represent some kind of urtext of the form, they might also be films that have just sort of withstood the test of time and that we still really, really love.
Sometimes you see the blurb on the new movie, instant classic. Is there such a thing, or does some time have to pass before a movie can become a classic?
I think some time has to pass. I mean, that's kind of like saying, you know, this new film is a cult classic. I don't think the distributor gets to decide what's a cult movie.
Well, we've got one clip of one that you've actually talked to us before, I believe, one of your classic favorites. Let's start with this one, Singin' in the Rain, 1952 musical. Let's take a little listen.
Come on now, snap out of it. You can't let a little thing like this get you down. Why, you're Donald Lockwood, aren't you? And Donald Lockwood's an actor, isn't he? Well, what's the first thing an actor learns? The show must go on. Come rain, come shine, come snow, come sleet, the show must go on. So, Reedy, Pagliacci, Reedy.
Reedy, huh?
Yeah. Don, the world is so full of a number of things. I'm sure we should all be as happy as... But are we? No. Definitely no. Positively no. Decidedly no.
Why does that one stand out as a classic for you?
Oh, wow. This is probably the movie that I have watched the most number of times of any movie that I've ever seen. And right there, we heard Donald O'Connor as Cosmo and Gene Kelly as Don Lockwood. And I think Singin' in the Rain is just such an absolute classic movie for several reasons. First of all, it is a movie that comes out toward the end of the classical Hollywood era. So it really represents just the perfection, like the absolute craftsmanship that Hollywood was really capable of achieving at that moment in time. It is a Technicolor extravaganza. It's an MGM musical. It is lavish. It has stars we love like Gene Kelly, but also Debbie Reynolds and Gene Hagen and Sid Charisse. But the other thing to me that makes it such a classic is that it doesn't just deal in what might be happening in 1952. It's actually a movie that's about Hollywood's transition to sound. It all takes place at the end of the 1920s. So we have this wonderful nostalgic description, this nostalgic visual and oral description of what Hollywood was like in the late 1920s. So it's kind of Hollywood playing itself. And that makes it both outrageously fun and something that encourages us to think about how film changes over time. Plus, who doesn't love Gene Kelly's dancing? It's just a thing of beauty.
We're talking about classic movies with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Lots of callers waiting, Jocelyn. I want to check out another one that I didn't know about. A Czechoslovakian film, Markéta Lazarová, made in 1967. What is that about? Why is it a classic?
Well, we can't just think that only American movies are classics, right? And this is another one of my very favorite films. This is, as you noted, a 1967 film from the former Czechoslovakia. And it's made in the kind of high moment of the Czech New Wave, which is when all of these kinds of new possibilities were opening up for Czech artists. It's partially because there's this moment, you know, of the Prague Spring in the end of the 1960s, when Soviet forces draw back a bit and there's less censorship in former Czechoslovakia. And this film is just a wonderful example of all of the cinematic possibilities that were just kind of blossoming in that moment. It is a beautiful film that takes place in the Middle Ages, but it's about the clash between the pagan and the Christian. But it's not done in your normal kind of like historical drama mode. Instead, it's all about trying to depict what the experience of living in that moment in time might have been like. So it works on so many different levels. It is an awesome action movie. It is filled with action. It's so exciting, but it's also really indicative of what kinds of forms of cinema were really possible at this moment in the 1960s. And it's also about the long history of the Czech people. It is just an absolutely spectacular film. And I wanted to bring that up because I was hoping a lot of listeners might get interested in it and watch it.
That's Markéta Lazarová from 1967, a Czech film. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Share your classic movies. Kay starts us off in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I seldom buy a movie, but I love Casablanca.
What is it that makes Casablanca a classic to you, Kay?
Well, to me, it's a beautiful love story, but I love the black and white photography.
All right, Kay. I think a lot of people would say Casablanca. I'm more a Maltese Falcon kind of guy. Guy, Jocelyn, what do you think?
I mean, I do love Bogey, but my favorite is In a Lonely Place of his films. But got to go with Casablanca all the time, too.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kay. And are there movies like that, Casablanca, that you think a lot of people are just going to have on their classic list, Jocelyn?
Sure. I think Citizen Kane is one that many, many folks will turn to. And I think that's a good example of how the notion of a classic changes over time, because Citizen Kane wasn't necessarily celebrated when it came out. It was kind of weird. It was sort of out there. And it's only as time has gone on that that has become a real classic film.
As time goes by. Got it. Yeah. Dennis joins us next in Racine. Dennis, hi.
Yes, I recommend absolutely seeing Gone with the Wind. That's a classic of that era. That's an absolute classic with Harlem Gable at his absolute best. Chloe.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. And I think adjusted for inflation, anyway, one of the top grossing movies of all time. Some views have changed on that movie in hindsight, though. Jocelyn, can you talk about Gone with the Wind as a classic?
Sure. Yeah, that's also a really interesting film that I saw that with my grandma in the theater, actually, in not when it first came out, not in 1939. I just want to clarify that. But in a repertory theater in the 1990s, and it was still really epic and sweeping. It's interesting for so many reasons, but one of the things that we think about right now is certainly its depiction of the antebellum South. And I want to recommend the work of Jacqueline Stewart, who's introducing that film for HBO now. She's done a lot of work with TCM as well, and she's a really incredible historian who talks about how our understanding of that film has really changed over time.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Daniel next in Plover. Daniel, hi.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I would say To Have and Have Not is my favorite film. It's the same story as Casablanca, just told in the Caribbean instead of North Africa, and it's just full of so many good lines, and the chemistry between Bogey and Bacall is really remarkable, and it's just a fun movie.
To Have and Have Not, and I'll say I have not seen that one, Jocelyn.
You're missing out. A classic Howard Hawks film, and also from the moment of classical Hollywood cinema. Bacall. Love Bacall.
Daniel, thanks for the call. That reminds me, Jocelyn, I mean, we could spend a lot of time talking about all the movies I should have seen that I haven't seen. What are your thoughts on movie missing out shame?
Oh, yeah, we should have an acronym for that, but I'm not going to come up with it right now. I think a lot of us experience that. And when I was in graduate school doing my PhD in film and media studies, a lot of fellow graduate students would sit around together and talk about the most shameful films we were missing from our spectatorial experience. So I think everybody has that kind of a feeling.
All right. No shame, people. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about classic movies. What's yours, however you define classic? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about classic movies. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. And you can join in with your classics at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. George is with us in Delavan. George, hello.
Hello.
Hi, what do you want to share with us, George?
Yeah, I'm coming from the standpoint of with kids and grandkids. So Matilda, to watch with the grandkids, and we always watch Princess Bride with my own children.
George, thanks a lot for that call. And that's another take on a classic movie, Jocelyn. Maybe that movie you're looking forward to sharing with another generation.
Yeah, I think that's such a good way to think about it, most definitely. And The Princess Bride is a great one to share with all sorts of family members. I think that's one that a lot of people like to show to the newer generations.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rob with us in Green Bay. Rob, hi.
Hi. Going back to a little bit older version, I put my vote in for Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest.
Oh, and I bet, Rob, are there other Hitchcock movies that you would put on your list, or is that the standout one for you?
Well, definitely Rear Window and others are great. Psycho, obviously, but I really like North by Northwest as kind of the precursor to the action-adventure suspense film where they start, it's a mistaken identity situation, and they start in New York, and they end up going cross-country through Chicago and all the way out to Mount Rushmore, and just really some neat technical shooting by Hitchcock in that movie, and the suspense thriller, that the dialogue, especially between Cary Grant and Marie Saint on the train, is so snappy and before its time. There's just a lot of great aspects to it.
Fantastic, Rob. Thanks for that. Jostle a little Hitchcock there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think really on the nose in terms of the technical mastery of that film, too, especially that very famous crop duster sequence where Cary Grant gets chased by the crop duster airplane in the fields. But of course, he and the crop duster, they were never actually in the same shot together. It's just the magic of special effects and rear projection. It's absolutely masterful.
Thanks for the call. Ted joins us now in Lone Rock. Ted, hi.
Hi, I wanted to contribute two titles to your discussion. One is Failsafe by Sidney Lumet. It's got a whole host of wonderful actors in it. Henry Fonda, Walter Matthau, Larry Hagman, and an incredible performance, dramatic performance, small featured role by Dom DeLuise, a great comedian. This is a serious role for him. But I remember seeing it. I'm close to 70 years old right now, and I remember seeing it when it came out, probably in the 60s, I'm guessing. And it deals with the arms race, the Cold War. And it is the be-all and end-all of nuclear proliferation and how dangerous it is. And the other film that I was a kid seeing was called Shoes of the Fisherman. And that stars Anthony Quinn. And it is this incredible story about a man. This was before we had our first non-Italian pope. Anthony Quinn becomes pope, but it's got a fairy tale ending. The world is in chaos. World War III is about to happen. And the Catholic Church, through Anthony Quinn's portrayal of the pope, solves it by saying he will give up all the riches of the church to feed the hungry. So there won't be a World War III.
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. Well, there's ones that stood the test of time for Ted. He's remembering seeing these as a youth in the 60s, and they are still front of mind for him, clearly, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that really hits me on a personal level because Failsafe was one of my dad's favorite films. Oh. And so I watched that with my dad when I was a kid. He was a big peace activist in the 60s. So that one holds some particular resonance for me that I don't think I can even have real critical thinking about that one because I associate it so deeply with my father.
Thank you so much for sharing those with us, Ted. Cheryl is with us now in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi.
Hi there. It wouldn't be Christmas without White Christmas, first part of the season. I like that.
Every year for you, Cheryl?
Yep. Starts the Christmas off.
All right. Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. White Christmas, Jocelyn.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about that movie the last time I was
on. We did indeed, yeah.
Yeah, great example of using the magic of color film.
Thanks for that call. We are talking about classic movies. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us from UW-Milwaukee. You can join in. The phone lines are full. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Jocelyn, before we get back to our callers, one more film you wanted to share with us, a little more recent, 1989, My 20th Century, a Hungarian movie.
Yeah. I mean, I have to be true to myself, which is bringing up the esoterica as much as possible. this is a film I absolutely adore. It's by this filmmaker, Ildikó Anyeti. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'm not Hungarian, so forgive me. And it's a really fine film that takes on these two twin sisters who are separated, and then they have these two different life experiences. But they're coming of age at the turn of the 20th century. And it's really a film that's about a love letter to cinema. It's about how cinema has ended up inflecting all of our experiences in the 20th century. Of course, this is made toward the end of the 20th century. It's really looking back at almost 100 years of film production and thinking about what that's meant for culture and what that's meant for our shared dreams and our shared imagination. It is an absolutely beautiful, magical film. And I really wanted to bring that one up because it never was available in the United States. You had to go through a lot of different channels to try to see it for a long time. But just recently, Kino Lorber has restored it. And as of about a month ago, you can see it on just about any streaming platform. So I think that's a really great example of an older film that is having new life. And I just really want everybody to enjoy it as much as I do.
That's My 20th Century from Hungary. Let's go back to your calls now. Brian is with us in Benton. Brian, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Brian?
It's called Captain Fantastic. Viggo Mortensen starred in it. It's a great movie about the bonds of family and the loss of a loved one due to mental illness.
Interesting. And that's a more recent one, I think. I'm looking it up, 2016. So a recent Captain Fantastic, Jocelyn, I have not seen that. Have you seen that? Or are there any more recent ones that leapt to classic status for you in that way?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen that one either, but I do want to bring up Viggo Mortensen because I think that he's the reason maybe I'll speculate given that I haven't seen the film. I think he might be the reason in large part that maybe somebody might think about this one as a classic because he has that real gravitas that older film stars really did, right? He's really somebody that we might place in an older film. So I think depending on who the actor is, that also might lend classic status to a film.
Thanks for that call. Time for at least one more call or maybe two. Andy is on the line in Milwaukee. Andy, hi.
Hello. I've got about 100 movies that I could name, but the one that I never miss is the Preston Sturges classic, Sullivan's Travels. I think it was 1940. Really a movie. It's got comedy. It's got all the seriousness you could want, and it's just a great movie.
Sullivan's Travels. Travels, yes. I just looked it up. 1941, it looks like, Jocelyn.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, anything Preston Sturges, just an absolutely brilliant writer and director. Even when he wasn't directing really fine films like Sullivan's Travels, which is just, it's just sparkling. It is delightful. But he also wrote a lot of screenplays before turning to directing as well. And if you think you don't like older comedies, then I think watch some Preston Sturges. He is just, he's so funny.
We've gotten so many emails. We'll get to them all. Pete in Reedsburg says it's all about Eve. A young person's cultural education wouldn't be complete until they've seen a certain Betty Davis movie. All About Eve, Jocelyn.
I just totally agree. I love All About Eve so much. I made my students watch it in my classical Hollywood class just a couple years ago. For me, it's Betty Davis all the way. I mean, I just love her so much. And It is kind of a classic story of competition. It's catty, it's campy, it's backstabbing, it's got everything. It's wonderful.
And Jocelyn, in our last half a minute or so, one thing that's hard to do these days is see a movie in a theater, much less classic movies in theaters. Do they still, a lot of them, hold up as well on the home screen?
You know, some of them do. I think it's always the best to see a film where it was meant to be shown, which is usually the big screen. But maybe you're like me, and during this pandemic, you took the opportunity to get a giant television. That could help a little bit with your spectatorial experience. I think a really good film, a really classic film, is still going to be a thrilling and fulfilling experience no matter where you watch it.
Jocelyn, it's been a lot of fun and it flew by. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
It did. Thanks so much for having me on.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. We talked today about classic movies. Maybe we'll do it again sometime soon. Thanks for everybody who called in. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, does all natural mean that something is better for us? A guest says we sometimes get things wrong because of the appeal to nature fallacy, and that's caused problems during the pandemic. Plus on Food Friday, maple syrup. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's something I saw today that made me look at money in a different way. I came across a thing that's making the rounds online. It's a guide for international students at MIT in Massachusetts. It answers common questions about things in American culture that are confusing for students from other countries. Like when an American says, "How are you?" They don't really want to know. That kind of thing. But here's one common question, apparently, that surprised me. What is a dime worth? And that seemed really specific. Why would a dime be more confusing than other coins? Well, the answer sent me to my change collection. If you look at a penny, it says the words 1 cent. So you know what that's worth. A nickel has the words 5 cents. Easy. A quarter says quarter dollar. Great. What's a dime worth? Quoting from the lettering on a dime, it's worth 1 dime. Not 10 cents, not a tenth of a dollar. Like, apparently it's from the French for 1/10, but I didn't know that until today, and I've been using dimes for a really long time now. Every other coin explains itself, but not the dime. You have to come to the situation with advanced knowledge to understand that one. So to help those future students, tourists, and immigrants figure out how much money to pay and how much change to expect, it seems like it'd be easy to change the dimes of the future to, say, 10 cents instead of 1 dime. That's just my 10 cents. This is Central Dime.